This conclusion was borne out by examination of the other heads in the collection. Three were pineapples, one was a melon, and another a coconut. She waited until the right moment came to raise the subject with one of her informants in the village, the sister of the headman, who had been delegated to act as hostess to Domenica. She communicated with this woman in Pidgin, the lingua franca of the region. "This head," she said, pointing to the painted coconut, "this head belong coconut tree, not belong man." The woman looked shocked.
"No," she said, "this head belong bad man belong people belong next door. Owner head belong spirit world, now belong no head people."
"No," said Domenica, "me belong University of Edinburgh, belong Scotland, belong Scottish Enlightenment. Me too much clever, no coconut when I see one."
The woman stared at her for a moment. "All right, all right," she said at last, switching to Australian-accented English. "There hasn't been head-hunting for ages, but you know how men are. They love to boast about physical exploits."
"Oh, I know all about that," said Domenica, also abandoning Pidgin. "We have rugby back in Scotland. It's much the same thing."
"We should send one of our people over to do some field work," joked the woman.
Domenica had laughed, but now, sitting in her kitchen with a letter in her hand, she remembered this conversation from all those years ago and experienced a certain sense of déjà vu.
"Angus," she said, "I really must tell you about a letter I've received from somebody up at the university."
Angus looked interested. "How nice that somebody still writes actual letters. What does it say?"
Domenica unfolded it. "Apparently they're getting visitors from Rwanda."
"Ah, yes," said Angus. He was good at maps, and he could picture Rwanda tucked away under Uganda, with beneath it. What exactly was beneath Rwanda?
"Well," continued Domenica, "apparently Creative Scotland has given a grant to somebody to bring some forest people over to Scotland for a visit."
"Forest people?" said Angus. "Who exactly would they be?"
"They used to be called pygmies," said Domenica. "These days they're often called forest people, but they themselves don't object to the term pygmy, as long as it's used with respect."
"I see," said Angus. "And what has this got to do with us?"
"They, that is Creative Scotland, would like us to help to entertain them. I suppose it's because they know I'm an anthropologist."
"How does one entertain forest people?" asked Angus.
Domenica frowned. "I'm sure they require little entertainment. Everything I've ever read about them suggests that they are charming, gentle people who will make ideal guests."
"Oh, well," said Angus, "they won't take up much room, will they?"
Domenica smiled. "Good gear in Smarbuke," she said.
Chapter 9. Cavafy's Poem. As Angus and Domenica contemplated the impending visit to Scotland of the Rwandan forest people, or pygmies, at Nine Mile Burn, just outside Edinburgh, Matthew and Elspeth were busy putting their triplets, Tobermory, Roganvald, and Fergus, to bed. Matthew sensed his wife's exhaustion, and had it been possible for him to deal with bedtime single-handed, he would have offered to do so. But it was physically impossible for one person, however adept at handling small children, to cope with the three young boys, now just past their second birthday, and endowed with apparently boundless energy, inordinate appetites, and incorrigible boisterousness.
"I've had it," said Elspeth, as they manoeuvred the boys into the bath. "I'm absolutely whacked. Finished."
Matthew reached out to put a sympathetic arm on his wife's shoulder.
"I know how you feel," he said.
She glanced at him. She wasn't sure that Matthew did know.
He spent most of the day at work while she looked after the boys, and so it was easy for him to tackle bedtime when he arrived home. He would have the boys for no more than an hour, while she did a quick mental calculation. She had been on duty for exactly 12 hours ever since Tobermory, who always woke up first, had called out from his room that there was a lion under his bed. "You go," Elspeth had muttered as she emerged into consciousness. Matthew grunted.
"It's Tobermory," said Elspeth, louder now. "Could you go and deal with the lion?"
Matthew grunted again. "Where do all these lions come from?" He was going on about lions last night. "Have you been reading them stories about lions?"
"No," said Elspeth. "I haven't. But Birgitta and her friend..."
Matthew snorted as he hauled himself out of bed. "It's their fault. I should have known." The girls in question were the two Danish au pairs, Birgitta and Anna, who had stayed with Matthew and Elspeth for some time before their contrariness, manifested in disagreements about virtually everything, coupled with a sullen, resentful sensitivity to even the slightest criticism, had led to the ending of their contracts.
"They had some ghastly Danish children's book that they'd found somewhere or other," Elspeth continued. "They used to translate it for the boys. It was all about a lion that ate his way through an entire village, polishing everybody off one by one."
"Scandinavian noir for children," said Matthew. "It's completely unsuitable."
"Well, that's where these particular lions come from," said Elspeth. "Those girls!"
Matthew made his way down the corridor to the triplets' room. Opening the door, he saw that Tobermory was standing up in his cot, rattling the bars, while his brothers continued to sleep.
"There's a lion," said the child, "right under the bed."
Matthew yawned.
"There are no lions in Scotland," he said patiently. "But Daddy will look, just to be sure."
He bent down and peered under the bed. A stuffed toy lion lay there on its side, its button eyes glaring at Matthew with all the intensity of a real lion on the African savannah. For a moment they looked at one another. "Don't run away from a lion. Instinct will drive them to pursue you." "So what does one do?" Matthew asked himself.
"Oh," said Matthew, "there's a lion." "That's what I said," crowed Tobermory.
Matthew retrieved the toy and handed it to his son.
"There," he said. "Nice lion."
Tobermory took the creature.
"Love," he said, hugging it to him.
Matthew reached down to pick him up.
"What did you say, darling?" "Love," said Tobermory. "What's love?" "Love," repeated the little boy, flourishing the lion.
That was 12 hours ago. 12 hours that had been filled with domestic crises of one sort or another, a fight between two of the boys, the breaking of a cafetiere that covered the kitchen floor with slivers of glass, the regurgitation by Roggenvold of his breakfast over a newly upholstered chair, the loss, somewhere in the garden, of one of Tobermory's shoes, a difficult telephone call from a somewhat clingy friend, all of which were fairly typical incidents in Elspeth's day. She wondered how many more such days lay ahead of her. The boys would go to school at about 5 years of age, which meant that she had just under 3 years to endure, which made about 1,000 days. The thought defeated her, and she made the decision to tackle Matthew that night. She would have to have help. After the experience of the two young Danes, they'd decided they would try to manage by themselves, but now she realized that this was simply impossible. She would contact Mother's Angels, the agency she had used to find the Danes, and throw herself upon their mercy. The boys, having been bathed, clad in their tartan pajamas, and read to by Matthew, a short and repetitive book that was chosen as the antithesis of juvenile Scandinavian noir, Elspeth retreated to the kitchen. There she poured herself a gin and tonic and informed Matthew of her decision.
"We can't cope," she said. "Or rather, I can't."
Matthew did not argue.
"We have to get somebody." "I'm not going to get another girl," said Elspeth. "I want an au pair boy."
Matthew was surprised, but said nothing.
"A Spanish boy," said Elspeth, taking a generous sip of her gin. "Why Spanish?"
Elspeth explained. Her cousin in Dundee had employed a young Spaniard who had been popular with her children.
"He played football with them," Elspeth said. "They loved him."
Matthew looked thoughtful.
"But will you be able to find one?" "There are any number of them. Unemployment in Spain is so high, one in five young Spanish males has no job."
Matthew winced. "How did that happen?" Elspeth sighed.
"Something to do with..."
She shrugged and mentioned the reason for the economic woes of the Spaniards, the Italians, the Greeks. Matthew smiled. "How useful to have a scapegoat to blame for all one's problems.
But what if it really is the scapegoat's fault?"
"Ah," said Matthew, and then, "ah," again. He thought of something. "Have you ever read Cavafy?" he asked. "That Greek poet. He lived in Alexandria, and he wrote a wonderful poem called Waiting for the Barbarians. The barbarians don't arrive, and the people think about how they were a really convenient solution to their problems. The waiting, that is." He paused. "The thing you fear may sometimes be the solution."
"Are we waiting?" she asked. "I mean, are we, here in Scotland, waiting for something?"
Matthew looked out of the window. It was hard to tell. He thought they were waiting, possibly, but then he wasn't quite sure what they were waiting for. Chapter 10. O Tempora, O Mores. In the Scottish Office of Statistics in Leith, a meeting was being attended by Stuart Pollock, senior statistician, father of Bertie and Ulysses, and of course husband of Irene, although she herself never used the patriarchal term husband, preferring ally, which expressed, she felt, the conditional, egalitarian goals of the relationship more widely known as marriage. Not everybody, of course, understood the term ally in this context. The plumber, for instance, had looked blank when Irene had mentioned that she would need to consult her ally about the installation of a new showerhead. "Stuart," she explained when she noticed his incomprehension, "I must talk to Stuart."
"Ah," said the plumber, "your man."
Irene had bristled.
"I don't own him," she said.
"No, of course not. But he's your man, isn't he?"
"We are an alliance," said Irene coldly.
The plumber had not pressed the point, but had bitten his lip.
"You certainly encounter them," he said to his wife that evening, "especially in Edinburgh."
The alliance between Irene and Stuart had lasted for 10 years. Irene didn't think much of anniversaries, which she regarded as sentimental celebrations largely encouraged by the makers of greetings cards.
"The fact of the matter," she said, "is that for many women so-called marriage is a sentence. Would you send a card to somebody when they've served 15 years or whatever of a sentence? I think not."
Stuart didn't argue, confining himself to the mild observation that, for some people, at least, an anniversary might be a reminder of happiness and its duration.
"False consciousness," muttered Irene. "People don't necessarily know what their true condition is."
He thought he might say that people who thought they were happy probably were happy, but he did not. There was no winning an argument with Irene, and he merely sighed, but not audibly, of course. Release for him came in the office, whence he could escape on weekdays from 8 in the morning until 5:30, when he returned to Scotland Street to put Bertie and Ulysses to bed. That gave him 9.5 hours of freedom, during which nobody accused him of anything. Nobody corrected him, and nobody made him feel that he should be thinking and saying something he did not agree with. He enjoyed his work, which was largely concerned with presenting facts and figures in such a way that was positive rather than negative. In particular, he was responsible for making economic prospects look good, even if the figures suggested otherwise. So if there were, for example, a £15 billion deficit in public spending, this could be presented as a marked improvement on the £16 billion deficit forecast by some others. "We have such fun," Stuart observed to one of his colleagues in another department. "It's creative work, you know. In fact, you'd think Creative Scotland would give us a grant for what we do." Stuart wasn't overly ambitious. He had been an academic high flyer as a young man, graduating with one of the best first-class honours degrees awarded at a Scottish university that year, and this had been followed by 2 years of work on a PhD. Financial pressures put an end to that, as he had already met Irene and they had decided to buy the flat in Scotland Street. Stuart needed a job, and the Scottish Government post offered a reasonable salary and access to a preferential mortgage. Over the years he got the promotions that one would expect, moving slowly up the grades, but had now reached the point where, if he were to be promoted further, he would need to go before a special board. This board was informally called the Perspex Ceiling, and it made recommendations for head of department appointments and above. The people who occupied these positions were known as mandarins, and were, ex officio, eligible for membership both of Muirfield Golf Club, subject to certain conditions, and the new club, should they so desire. Irene had no time for mandarins, but, rather in the manner of Lady Macbeth, was ambitious for her husband/ally. Apart from anything else, money was tight, and the additional salary would be more than welcome. So when Stuart was told at work one day that he was to be invited before the Perspex Ceiling, he realized that, whatever his own feelings about occupying a much more senior post, Irene would require him to apply. The information about his selection came from his closest friend in the office, Morrison Purvis. Morrison was only a few years away from retirement, and so had no interest in further promotion, but was keen for Stuart to be successful. "I shouldn't be telling you this," he said, "but..." It was the usual preface to an important piece of information. "Of course you don't have to tell me if you don't want to," Stuart assured him. That, too, was the standard reply to such an overture, and it meant the opposite of what it said. "No, I'll tell you because I know how discreet you are," continued Morrison. That, again, was very much in the script, and once it had been said, the information could be revealed. "Three of you are going up for interview," said Morrison, his voice lowered. "Would you like to know who the other two are?" For a few moments Stuart attempted to look indifferent, but then he nodded conspiratorially. "If you insist," he said. "All right," said Morrison, his voice lowered even further. "That 84-horsepower Sook, Elaine."
"Oh, no," said Stuart, "not her."
"And that snivelling toady, Faith." Stuart cast his eyes up to the ceiling.
"What a field!"
"You've got to get it, Stuart," went on Morrison. "If either of them gets chosen, I'm bringing forward my retirement. Guaranteed." "Elaine can't even do long division," said Morrison. let alone statistics. Stuart smiled. And Faith?
Have you seen her with the politicians? Asked Morrison. She sends them birthday cards. Can you believe it? She gets their birthdays from Who's Who in Scotland, and she sends the card. They love it.
O tempora, o mores, muttered Stuart.
Come again? Asked Morrison.
It's Latin for geez, explained Stuart.
Chapter 11 Tolerance and Intolerance. Morrison said to Stuart,
How about going to the old chain pier? We can talk more freely there.
The old chain pier was a well-known bar perched on the shore at New Haven, once festooned with old fishing floats and maritime paraphernalia. They were sitting in the staff canteen at the time, and it was there, over a standard civil service lunch, healthy option, that Morrison had given the news to Stuart that he was on the short list for promotion.
No, replied Morrison, I don't mean that we can't talk, it's just that, well, I detect a certain change in the atmosphere in this place recently. I don't think we can speak quite as freely as we used to.
Stuart raised an eyebrow.
You mean there's less freedom of opinion?
Morrison looked over his shoulder.
To an extent, he hesitated. And not just here. Everywhere.
You aren't overreacting, are you?
Morrison shook his head.
Liberty can drain away very slowly. So slowly, in fact, that you may not even notice it. We lost freedom of speech some time ago. You can't say what you think these days, can you?
About some things, yes, but not everything. Far from it.
Stuart considered this. In some areas, perhaps. You certainly can't insult others. You can't whip up hostility against them. He paused. And don't you think that's a good thing? Don't you think it was about time people stopped demeaning others? Morrison stared at Stuart as if weighing him up, as if uncertain whether to trust him. When he answered, he spoke cautiously.
I'm not suggesting it's a good thing to demean people. What I'm worried about is the creation of a climate of fear, so that people feel they can't say anything that might offend some group.
Give me an example, said Stuart.
Morrison looked about him again.
All right, he said, his voice lowered. Let's say you take the view that you shouldn't be able to change the sex you're born into. Let's say you believe that people who have sex change operations are still men or women because that's what they are chromosomally. Can you express that view?
Stuart shrugged. Yes, if that's what you think. As far as I'm concerned, though, I see nothing wrong with sex change. People in that position feel very strongly about what they are. Why prevent them from living their lives as they want to?
That's not the point, said Morrison. I happen to agree with you on that, but there are some who don't. The point I'm making is this. Should those who take a different view be allowed to express it?
Stuart shrugged again. Who's stopping them? It's not illegal to express an opinion on that.
Not yet, said Morrison. But you could lose your job if you did.
Oh, come on.
Or be crucified on the social media, Morrison continued, or deplatformed like Germaine Greer.
Well, I don't condone that, conceded Stuart, but think what's at stake here. In the past, we've been so casual about hurting people about allowing people to be disparaged because they're different in some way. If you disparage people for what they are, then you're saying something about their nature, about who they are. You're saying you don't count as much as others because of what you are. He paused. And that's pretty devastating, isn't it? Morrison looked down at the floor. It seemed to Stuart that his friend looked rather ashamed of himself, and so he added, Not that I think you're saying any of that. It's all a question of kindness, isn't it? And you're fundamentally kind. He sensed that something unexpectedly raw and difficult had opened up between them, a difference of opinion that went rather deep. Morrison looked up.
Look, I don't have any difficulty with people being whatever they happen to be. It's not that at all. It's just that I don't like being told that I can't express a view, or can't even hold a view. And what about religion? What are we allowed to say about that?
Stuart shrugged.
You can express a view if you want to. You can say that religious belief is a delusion, if that's what you think. Nobody's stopping you from saying that. But I can't sing certain songs.
Stuart hesitated. You mean the sash my father wore? Morrison nodded.
You shouldn't sing that at a football match. No, you shouldn't.
Morrison sighed.
Well, there you are. We've now become a society that stops people singing the wrong songs.
Stuart was reluctant to let that pass.
That's not about religion, anyway. That's all about group antagonisms. And why would you sing it? You'd sing it to taunt others. You'd sing it to encourage a bit of rammy between Protestants and Catholics. You'd sing it to promote division and hatred.
Morrison hesitated.
I wouldn't sing it, and I don't know the words anyway.
Stuart began to hum the opening bar, then the words, It's old, but it is beautiful. Morrison turned pale.
Shh!
Don't worry, said Stuart, smiling. I won't sing it, but there are plenty of people who would, and they'd sing it to stir up trouble. They'd sing it to start a fight, and surely we're entitled to say that we don't want people fighting with one another.
Morrison was silent. Then he said,
I wouldn't want you to think I'm reactionary, he said.
Stuart smiled.
Anything but that.
It's just that I get the feeling, Morrison continued, that there's an imposed consensus, that there are people who want us all to think in the same way and are using pressure of various sorts, social disapproval as well as real sanctions, to ensure that people toe an ideological line.
Stuart thought of Irene. He almost said, I'm married to one, but loyalty prevented him.
I've got nothing against much of this, Morrison continued. I've got nothing against correcting the injustices of the past, including all the injustices that women have had to bear. It's just that I still believe that an old injustice doesn't justify a new injustice.
Ah, said Stuart. Morrison fixed Stuart with an intense gaze. He leaned forward as he spoke.
And there's a line in the sand right here in this building, he whispered. And if either of those two, Elaine or Faith, gets the job, then it's the end of tolerance and it's hello witch hunts. I'm warning you, Stuart, this is deadly serious.
Stuart sat back in his chair.
Don't you think you're overstating it a bit?
Morrison shook his head.
I'm not, Stuart. I'm telling you as it is. Those two have an anti-male agenda. They're
every bit as bad as men who have an anti-female agenda. There's no difference. Or there is, perhaps, in that they've got the zeitgeist on their side. They've got the rhetoric, Stuart.
I think you're being unreasonable, Morrison, Stuart said evenly. The world has changed. Old privileges and old attitudes are out. Accept it.
Morrison rose from his chair. All right, but don't say I didn't warn you.
Chapter 12. The View from Dunfermline. Stuart felt unsettled by the conversation with Morrison. He was fond of his colleague, and it saddened him to think that he should feel alienated from the world he worked in. But that, he supposed, wasn't surprising. Morrison was approaching retirement, and at that age people commonly felt at odds with social progress. Every generation made that discovery, Stuart thought. The world changed. Of course it did, and not everyone found it easy to accommodate these changes. Yet many of these changes were not bad ones. Far from it. They were introduced to help people feel better about themselves, to lead happier lives, to be treated fairly and not discriminated against by those who had an advantage over them. No, he could sign up to all that. And not just because he was married to Irene and had experienced an extreme version of that agenda at full blast, but because he actually believed in the central values that such reforms embodied. What worried him, though, was that Morrison had been made so anxious, indeed frightened, by the prospect of one of the other candidates for promotion getting the post. Stuart did not like Elaine or Faith. He didn't like their only too obvious ambition, and the fact that they were always calculating the effect that anything they did would have on their superiors. There had been several instances where he had seen the advice they gave to ministers and had realized that what they said was the exact opposite of what he knew they believed. They gave this advice, though, because they knew that this is what the minister would want to hear. Everybody likes those who express their personal prejudices, and government ministers are no exception to that rule. Both Elaine and Faith knew that, and were prepared to act against their own better judgment if that meant a smile or a pat on the head from those in authority. It was sickening, thought Stuart. What's the point of having an independent civil service, he asked himself, if that same civil service is not going to give independent advice? He felt a strong dislike for those two, but he didn't really know either of them at all well. Elaine was the older. She was a tall, rather irritating woman in her mid-40s who came from Fife, a fact that she never tired of mentioning. Remarks on a wide range of subjects would be prefaced with, "Well, I'm from Fife, you see, and we..." There then followed some general local prejudice, set out in great detail and presented as if it were an example of deep wisdom only available to those who had the good fortunes to be born and brought up in Fife. Another of her expressions was, "We don't look at things that way in Dunfermline." That could be inserted into any discussion at any point, and was very effective in derailing the debate. For the most part, people were unsure what to make of it. Was there something about Dunfermline, some quality of higher rationality, that made it futile to question the Dunfermline view of things? Or was there an implicit suggestion that if any position were espoused that differed from the Dunfermline view, then there would be endless trouble in Fife and perhaps in many other places that were somehow in Fife's sphere of influence? He knew little of Elaine's personal circumstances. He'd been told that she was married, but he knew nothing of her husband, whom she mentioned from time to time, invariably adding, "He's originally from Kirkcaldy, you know," as if in explanation of all that he stood for. Stuart had heard that he was called Sammy, and that he ran a tree nursery near Ochtamachty.
He felt vaguely sorry for this Sammy, with his tedious wife and his tree nursery and all the worries and burdens that went with both of these. Elaine was very friendly with Faith, who was a strongly built woman with broad shoulders and a square chin. She had a master's degree from McGill University in Montreal, and insisted on listing this degree behind her name on any letter or circular she signed. It was also rumoured, although the accusation remained unproven, that the Christmas cards she sent to politicians were signed Faith McDougall, MSc, McGill. Faith very rarely spoke to Stuart, whom she seemed to ignore most of the time. If Stuart asked her a question at a meeting, Faith would answer it, but wouldn't look at him as she spoke, addressing her answer to Elaine, who would nod encouragingly as she spoke. "She doesn't acknowledge my existence," said Stuart to another colleague. "She doesn't see me." The colleague laughed. "She doesn't see me either," he said. "I wonder why?" asked Stuart. The colleague laughed again. "We're the enemy," he said. This explanation depressed Stuart. He felt it was quite unfair to be branded with the misdeeds of other men, men who treated women unfairly and could be thought to deserve this angry froideur in return. He wasn't like that, and yet she refused to hear him out, to see that he was not like the men against whom she was waging her campaign. "I've never personally been..." Stuart began, only to be cut short by his colleague.
"That's not the point," the colleague said. "This is status guilt. The moment you were born, you became part of the structures of oppression. Because you're male. It's nothing to do with choice, Stuart. Nothing to do with what you yourself think or feel."
Stuart sighed. It was the mark of Cain, a burden much the same as that borne by the offspring of enemies of the people in revolutionary Russia. It was inherited guilt, and no protestations of innocence, no rejection or disavowal of the iniquities of the past could remove the stain. He wondered how long this would last. Would it be there until the memory of the past faded completely, or would it last until men themselves had become the new oppressed class? And if that were so, then how long would the period of revenge last? He was thinking of this when the summons came for a meeting with the Supreme Head of Personnel. All three candidates were to attend, the note specified, to have explained to them the selection procedures that were to be followed to ensure a process that was transparent, equitable, and designed to achieve the best possible outcome. But what, Stuart wondered, was that? That the best candidate would be appointed? And best for what? That was the real question. That was where the demons lurked. Chapter 13. No Boys' Club Here.
"Now," said the Supreme Head of Personnel, "as you know, there are very carefully set out procedures."
Elaine nodded.
"Procedures, yes, procedures, unlike the bad old days when..."
She glanced at Stuart, who smarted under the implicit accusation that he had somehow been involved in the procedures of that benighted era. The Supreme Head of Personnel was reassuring.
"Ooh, I can assure you we're not going back to any of that."
Stuart struggled.
"Of what?"
Elaine glared at him.
"The Boys' Club approach." "Precisely," said the Supreme Head of Personnel. "We now have procedures that meet with all the requirements of public appointments. There will be an outside assessor. Then the position will be advertised."
"Where?" asked Stuart.
"On the notice board," said the Supreme Head of Personnel.
Stuart raised an eyebrow.
"What about people from outside?" "Not eligible," said the Supreme Head of Personnel abruptly.
This is a Category A position. Category A positions are not advertised outside the civil service, as per the relevant agreement.
With whom? Asked Stuart. All three women stared at him.
With the relevant union, answered the Supreme Head of Personnel.
Stuart sat back in his chair.
I see. And the outside assessor? How is he chosen?
She, said the Supreme Head of Personnel.
Stuart corrected himself. How's she chosen?
I've made the appointment, said the Supreme Head of Personnel, under the terms of the relevant regulation.
Are we allowed to ask who it is? Asked Stuart.
No, said the Supreme Head of Personnel. Now, on to the procedures themselves. There will be an initial declaration for you all to sign. This will ask certain questions, including one as to where you heard about the vacancy.
Stuart thought of his conversation with Morrison. Would he have to disclose that?
I heard about it on the grapevine, he said.
The Supreme Head of Personnel bristled.
That's not what we're after, Mr. Pollock. In fact, that's exactly the sort of thing we're trying to get beyond, the cozy passing on of information about these opportunities.
Well said, said Elaine. We need to expose that sort of thing.
Stuart turned to face her.
Where did you hear of it, then?
Elaine was momentarily taken aback, and Stuart pressed his advantage.
From a friend.
Elaine exchanged a glance with the Supreme Head of Personnel. Unknown to Stuart, she had heard from the Supreme Head of Personnel herself, who had telephoned her at home to pass on the news.
You don't have to answer that, said the Supreme Head of Personnel, and I'll regard the question as not having been asked.
But it was, said Stuart. I asked it. The Supreme Head of Personnel ignored this.
Now, there's another aspect to the process, she said. The resume, as you know, will be following the new form. We don't want personal details of a sort that would enable favoritism to be exercised. So we don't want any names on the resume itself, just a number. And we want no details of schools or universities attended.
Stuart sighed.
So, no reference to qualifications?
The Supreme Head of Personnel shook her head.
None. If we are seeking to avoid networking.
Stuart sighed again.
Surely it will be rather hard for the board to make a decision if they don't know anything about any of the candidates, such as their educational qualifications, their experience, their gender.
Oh, that must be revealed, said the Supreme Head of Personnel.
Stuart nodded.
Of course.
And there's an interesting new requirement, continued the Supreme Head of Personnel. Every candidate must write a short paper, not more than 2,000 words, on their vision for the job.
Stuart frowned.
Our vision for the job?
How you see the job as an opportunity to carry forward departmental objectives, explained the Supreme Head of Personnel.
It's not novel, and it's useful for us to know in advance what the successful candidate thinks she will do with the job.
Stuart raised a finger.
Yes, Mr. Pollock.
What she will do with the job? He said quietly.
The Supreme Head of Personnel looked puzzled.
Yes, that's what I said.
Stuart closed his eyes.
I see, he said.
You haven't already decided who's going to get this? He asked, and then added quickly and apologetically.
Just wondering.
Of course not, said the Supreme Head of Personnel. And frankly, I'm surprised that you would ask such a question.
The meeting came to an end,
As he returned to his office, Stuart was aware that someone was pursuing him down the corridor. He turned around and saw that it was Elaine.
"I want you to know," she said as she caught up with him, "I want you to know that even if this whole process is stacked against us, neither Faith nor I will hold anything against you."
Stuart caught his breath. "Stacked against you?"
"Yes," said Elaine. "We know what men are capable of."
Stuart could barely believe what he was hearing.
"But there aren't any men involved in the whole thing," he stuttered. It's all women, as far as I can see."
Elaine smiled.
"On the surface," she said, "but the underlying patriarchy is still there."
Stuart stared at her. Within him, deep within him, something snapped.
"I think you are seriously deluded," he said. "I think you're paranoid."
Elaine stopped in her tracks.
"You seriously compromised my personal space," she said, her voice filled with venom. "If I chose to make an issue of this, you'd be suspended, you know."
"Oh, do shut your face," said Stuart. Elaine screamed. Stuart stared at her. He felt a curious sense of detachment, of freedom.
"Do you realize how ghastly you are?" he said.
Elaine gasped.
"You hateful..." She struggled to find the right words. "You hateful, hateful..."
Stuart tried to help her.
"Hateful man? Yes, I'm a man. I can't help it. I was born that way, and that's what I am. I know I'm inferior. I know I'm no longer needed, but that's what I am, for better or worse, a man."
Elaine shook her head. Approaching him, she whispered her warning.
"Start the countdown, Stuart. Start the countdown to your early retirement. Very early retirement."
Chapter 14. Silk Sheets. Big Lou's day had begun at 6. It had been that way, summer and winter, for as long as she could remember. At Snell Mains, the mixed arable and stock farm on which she had been born and spent her childhood, the idea of staying in bed once you had awoken was anathema. Lying in bed was what lazy people did. People who lived in towns and cities, who had no cows to milk, no chickens to feed, no sheepdogs to let out of their kennels. Such people could lie in bed until unheard-of hours, 8 o'clock in extreme cases, listening to the radio or even drinking tea, leaving other people to do all the work that honest people from places like Angus and Aberdeenshire were up and about doing. At the age of 8, Big Lou had been taken to Dundee by a favourite aunt. After they had finished their shopping, they'd gone into a cinema where she had sat through a parental guidance-rated film. She had been thrilled at the maturity implicit in being allowed to see such a film, even if the aunt had whispered to her at one or two points that she should avert her eyes. Big Lou had complied, to an extent, clasping her hands firmly over her eyes but discreetly peeking through her fingers at what was happening on the screen. It was nothing exciting, as far as she could make out, but it did show a woman, a well-known actress of whom her aunt had often talked slightly disapprovingly, lying in a bed with silken sheets. Lou had concluded that this was the part of the film that was viewed as unsuitable for children, the main offence being that the woman in question was lying in bed after 6 o'clock. On the way back to our berth, Lou said,
"Auntie, that woman in the film..." "That well kent one, that Madame Bovary, aye, what of her?" "She was a bad woman, wasn't she?"
The aunt had considered her response.
"Definitely bad, Lou dearie, and she got what was coming to her. She had that bed with silk sheets, other folk who really have silk sheets."
The aunt did not hesitate.
"Aye, there are folk like that, Lou, not here in our broth, though, thank the Lord." "Where, auntie, where do they have these silk sheets?" "Edinburgh."
The aunt nodded.
"Edinburgh's one such place. There's a gay lot of that down there, I think. And they don't get up till all hours of the forenoon,
supplied the aunt. Some of them stay in bed until the afternoon. Would you believe it?
Till the afternoon?
Aye, said the aunt. But they get what's coming to them, sure enough.
Which is?
The Lord punishes them. He has a list, you see, of folk like that. He sorts them out soon enough. Don't you worry.
That attitude to sluggardly behaviour set Lou in good stead during the time she spent working at the Granite Nursing Home in Aberdeen. In all her years there, she was never late for work, not on a single occasion, and never objected to the early shift. Her loyalty to the home was to be spectacularly rewarded when one of the inmates, a man of considerable means, had left Lou his entire estate in gratitude, as his will put it, for all she has done for me and other unfortunates, for the heart of gold that beats within her. Lou did not immediately leave her job as a nurse's assistant, as many might do on benefiting from such a generous legacy, but continued for a good 6 months before handing in her resignation.
"Ah, Lou," said the matron, "I was hoping against hope that you'd stay, but you've deserved this, every penny of it. Now what?"
"Back to the farm for a while, matron," said Lou. "There's work to be done."
Matron smiled.
"Yes, there's always work to be done, isn't there, Lou? And you'll always do it, won't you? Nay complaint, nay bither."
"And then I thought maybe I'd try Edinburgh for a while."
The matron's eyes lit up.
"Edinburgh? You know, I lived in Edinburgh once for a year or two. I stayed in the nurse's home at the Royal Infirmary. Oh, we had a grand time, so we did. You had to work hard enough, and you had to be signed back into the home by 10 o'clock, but you were allowed to go to the dances in the University Union. They called them the Union Palais, and you could meet some awfully nice young men there. Medical students, often enough. We had a wonderful time back then."
She paused.
"I could write to somebody, Lou. I know a man down there who has a nursing home in a good part of town. He's always looking for reliable staff. I could write to him, if you liked. He's called Jimmy Watson, and I think his mother was from somewhere down your way from Arbroath, or maybe it was Montrose. There were plenty of Watsons in Montrose, but they weren't all related, you know. One of them had a haulage business that he'd advertise each week in the P&J. It was called Watson's Trucks, I mind. You saw them on the road all the time, muckle trucks that took cattle off to the sales and so on."
Lou listened. Although disinclined to complain, this was exactly what she wanted to get away from. This sense of being trapped in a world where everyone was somehow connected, where people knew where others came from and who their parents and grandparents had been. Lou wanted to see the world and to achieve something. She'd spent her entire life thus far in doing things for others. Now she wanted to create something that would be hers.
"I think I'll start a cafe," she said to Matron. "I'll use the money to buy a cafe in Edinburgh."
The idea had just occurred to her, then and there, but it seemed to be the right thing to do.
"Oh, you'll have the time of your life in Edinburgh," said Matron. "Start a cafe. You might meet a young man from Arbroath. They go down there, you know."
"I'll see," said Lou. "You never know."
"You could try the Union Palais," said Matron, but then, on second thoughts, added, "Well, maybe not."
Chapter 15. You Are the Sun. When Big Lou arrived in Edinburgh, she used almost the entire legacy to buy a two-bedroomed flat in Cannon Mills, overlooking a bend in the Water of Leith, and a former bookshop in Dundas Street. The bookshop, known for its associations with figures of the 20th century Scottish literary renaissance, had been frequented by poets such as Norman Macaig, C.M. Grieve, and Sidney Goodsir Smith. The proprietor's executors sold the shop with all its stock, which meant that Big Lou became the owner of a library of several thousand books on just about every subject. Big Lou moved the books, lock, stock and barrel, to the flat in Cannon Mills, where the motley collection became her private library, to be worked through, title by title, over the years that followed. Big Lou had left school at 16, a decision that was made for her by her parents without her views being sought. They felt that, by that age, she would be vested with sufficient skills to enter the workplace for a few years before, in due course, she married the son of a local farmer. What would count thereafter wouldn't be skills in mathematics, a knowledge of geography, or even an ability to understand basic French, but familiarity with the cleaning of a milking parlour, the ability to help ewes to lamb, and an understanding of the running of a farmhouse kitchen. At first, her lack of formal education didn't trouble Big Lou too much, but as the years passed, she became increasingly aware that there was a great deal she simply did not know. She started to read while she was working in Aberdeen, taking up authors who had something to say about the world she knew. Sunset Song struck her as being utterly and completely true. She knew those people, and The House with the Green Shutters shocked her with its accurate portrayal of meanness and greed in a rural setting. The acquisition of so large a library might have daunted many, but not Big Lou. She decided she would at least start every one of the titles in her new library, even if she wouldn't persist with those that she found uninteresting or out of date. She started with philosophy and the Scottish Enlightenment. She read Smith, Hume, and Hutcheson, along with commentaries on the works of all three of these. She moved on to George Davies' The Democratic Intellect and to Iris Murdoch's The Sovereignty of Good, which she appreciated greatly. Next was The Myth of Sisyphus by Albert Camus and Martin Buber's I and Thou, first courses for a prolonged meal of continental philosophy that included the words of Spinoza, whom Big Lou rather liked, and Schopenhauer, whom she liked rather less. These studious pursuits, along with the hard work involved in setting up and running her coffee bar, might have been expected to leave little time for socializing, but Big Lou was determined to take advantage of what Edinburgh offered. She met and became involved with a series of men, including a chef, a Jacobite plasterer, and an obsessive Elvis impersonator. None of the men she met was anything but a disappointment to her, with the result that she gradually came to accept that she was unlikely to meet the sort of man she would so dearly love to find, a man who would be intelligent, empathetic, and witty company, somebody like Angus, without the dog and the tendency to wear clothes spotted with paint, or Matthew, without his cardigan in distressed oatmeal or his trousers of mitigated beige, but not at all like the narcissistic Bruce Anderson, with his hair gel and constant gazing at himself in any nearby polished surface. Big Lou had caught him admiring his reflection on the front of her Gadger coffee maker, preening himself, she said. Now she was reconciled to remaining single, or at least to accepting the possibility that she wouldn't find a suitable partner. She would have been content enough with that. Men, she had decided, were on balance somewhat overrated, and anyway, somebody had come into her life who was already transforming it in ways she would never have thought possible. This was the young boy Finley, who had been allocated to her by the Social Welfare Department after Big Lou had offered to act as a foster parent. Finley, who was 7, the same age as Bertie Pollock, had had a difficult start in life. At first, the traumas of his earlier years had made him suspicious and silent, but as he settled in, these defences were gradually lowered. Big Lou was a woman of infinite patience. She knew what it was to nurse an orphaned or rejected lamb back to health. She'd done just that so many times in the lambing season, coaxing a tiny, confused creature, unsteady on its spindly legs, to take the teat of the milk bottle, encouraging strength and vitality drop by drop. Now she did the equivalent of that with a strange, freckled little boy who had come into her life, bringing him round to an acceptance of the love she offered him. He responded willingly, taking her hand in his when they walked down the street, clutching it to him as if frightened that the world of warmth and security she'd created for him might suddenly be snatched away. He thrived at school, no longer the shy and withdrawn child his teachers had earlier observed, but now the life and soul of the classroom, popular with the other children and appreciated for his winning smile. He drew a picture that was passed on to Big Lou by his class teacher.
"I thought you might like to see this."